Welcome. This is History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is A Man-Made Paradise. In the 19th century, James Garth Marshall created a picture-perfect lake above Coniston Water. Christopher Donaldson explores how Marshall and Beatrice Potter shaped this Lake District landscape. Fringed by woodland and grazing sheep, Tarn House is a Victorian-designed landscape, blending human ingenuity with the Lake District's natural beauty. Tarn House is one of the Lake District's best-loved beauty spots. Nestled in the fells north of Coniston Water, its scenery is picture-perfect. Writer Greville Lindrop reckons such lakeland pools have graced more calendars than Marilyn Monroe. But there's more to Tarn House than meets the eye. Like much of the Lake District, its natural splendor isn't all it seems. The name, Tarn House, comes from the Old Norse word for mountain pool and freestanding hill, meaning the hill by the pool. So it makes sense that in 1840, Thomas de Quincey called Tarn House a steep hill above Coniston Water. Yet that's not how visitors think about Tarn House today. When we hear the name, most of us envision a wood-fringed pond. Why is that? Who was it that put the tarn in Tarn House? Look into the matter, and you'll find it was the Liberal Party politician James Garth Marshall, 1802 to 1873. The son of the Yorkshire politician and flax-spinning magnate John Marshall, 1765 to 1845, he bought the land around Tarn House in the late 1830s. Marshall had three shallow ponds on the property, dammed to regulate the flow of water to a nearby sawmill. It wasn't only a practical measure, it also created the little tarn that attracts visitors today. Marshall then had decorative groves planted around the tarn in an effort to balance nature and industry. All this distinguishes Tarn House as a legacy of the Lake District's Victorian past. That was a time of massive change in the region, including in the development of its designed and ornamental landscapes. And that's what Tarn House is, an ornamental garden on a grand scale. Still, Tarn House wouldn't be what it is today without Beatrice Potter. A passionate conservationist, she purchased part of the estate in 1930 and invested in its care. Initially uncertain about the purchase, she found Marshall's designed landscape to be a little too theatrical, but she ensured its survival all the same. She and her husband, William, invested significantly in repairing walls and fences, refurbishing tenant cottages, tending stock, and looking after the property. Their influence can still be seen at Tarn House today, right down to the belted Galloways and Herdwick sheep that graze the property. Herdies and Belties were two of Potter's favorites. Potter eventually gave Tarn House to the National Trust, along with her other Lake District estates, entrusting the charity with balancing the legacy of Marshall's designs with the needs of our own time. And the Trust has underscored its commitment to maintaining the significant balance of both created and natural values that have existed at Tarn House for over 150 years. Striking that balance is crucial, and the Trust are working to do so by enhancing wildlife habitats and land management in collaboration with local farmers. They've also been working to stop the spread of Ramorum blight, sudden larch death, by felling trees around the property. That's changed the look of the place a little, but it's also part of what makes Tarn House an embodiment of the Lake District status as a cultural landscape, a place formed by the forces of nature and human industry. A man-made paradise, Tarn House may be too pretty to suit everyone, yet the story of its creation makes it a place well worth exploring all the same. Christopher Donaldson is a senior lecturer in cultural history at Lancaster University. Up next, what we've learned this month. James Osborne highlights four insights shared by experts on our History Extra podcasts. Ancient Egyptians were prolific cat killers. Cats appear to be venerated in the art of ancient Egypt, but they were bred and raised to be sacrificed as offerings to the gods. A sleek Egyptian cat is an ancient image immortalized in bronze statues and painted on tomb walls. Cats from the pharaonic period are preserved today in museums across the world in tiny sarcophagi or swaddled in linen. These traces have left many to assume the ancient Egyptians adored cats, treated them as beloved companions, and elevated them as sacred animals. But according to Manchester Museum curator and Egyptologist Campbell Price, this picture rests on a misunderstanding about the Egyptian belief system and says more about our own modern attitudes than about how they really saw cats. The ancient Egyptian belief system was polytheistic, Price says. There are lots of ancient Egyptian gods, and they are in a hierarchy. But divinity is in lots of different things, and you can encounter the gods in different places. And not just in geographical locales, but in dreams, natural forces, and crucially, living beings. Price believes that addressing ancient Egyptian faith as a belief system is more accurate than calling it a religion. It was flexible and capable of absorbing new deities and practices. Religious experience varied by region, shaped by local cults and traditions. What unified these variations was a shared understanding that divine power was infused within the material world and that humans could interact with it through physical acts. The truth is, gods could be resident in or experienced through lots of different things: rocks, rivers, dreams, and animals, says Price. However, he adds, we've put undue focus on the poor kitty cats. Put simply, cats were not exceptional. Crocodiles, falcons, bulls, fish, and dogs could all serve as vessels or intermediaries for divine presence. Temples often kept live animals as part of cult practice, but this didn't mean that the animals themselves were worshipped or loved. Animals were one part of a broader belief system built on the idea of exchange. Humans made offerings. The gods were expected to respond by granting protection, fertility, bountiful harvest, and health. It's not that ancient Egyptians worshipped animals, Price says. It's that the animals were a go-between stage between humanity and the gods. Born to be slaughtered. This is where the modern image of pampered moggies begins to unravel. Price explains the ancient Egyptians' view. The great thing about animals was that you could kill them and give them as gifts. By the late period, from around the first millennium BC, this logic reached an industrial scale. Animals were bred specifically to be sacrificed, mummified, and sold to pilgrims as offerings for the deities. Temples functioned partly as hubs of large-scale animal production. Cats, associated with the powerful and influential goddess Bastet, were especially prominent in this regard. Evacuations around cult centers have uncovered vast burial deposits of cats killed in her name. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of cats and kittens were raised and had their necks broken as part of an enormous industry of animal death, says Price. What it was that made the ancient Egyptians want to sacrifice animals? Today, in a Christian tradition, you might light a votive candle to help your prayer get to God, says Price. In ancient Egypt, you would buy a mummified cat or a crocodile or a falcon, and you would give that as a gift, not as a pet. That's not to say cats didn't live alongside humans in ancient Egypt, if only because felines controlled vermin. But this should not be confused with affection. The ancient Egyptians were using animals as a means of communicating with the gods, Price concludes. They were not venerating them. They were not viewing them as pets. We just have to let go of that modern perception. Next, England's first king weaponized silver to defeat the Vikings. In the early 10th century, the unification of England was an unfinished project. Despite Alfred the Great's victories against the Vikings and the consolidating achievements of his children, the influence of Norse raiders and their descendants hadn't simply disappeared. The Vikings had embedded themselves within this political landscape after their 9th century invasions had left much of eastern and northern England under Norse control, a region known as the Danelaw. They remained the greatest threat to any ruler hoping to govern a unified England. Edward the Elder's son, Æthelstan, was forced to confront this problem when he became king of the Anglo-Saxons in AD 924. He had a pressing need to take action. Despite his family's nation-building efforts, Æthelstan was surrounded by rivals. North settlers in the north, the kings of the Scot, and constellation of Welsh rulers to the west. Any one of these foes might ally with future Viking attackers. No place demonstrated the danger more clearly than York, which the Vikings had controlled for decades. Then, in AD 927, the Viking ruler died. Æthelstan moved decisively to exploit the opportunity this presented. Æthelstan marched quickly north and took over in York, says David Woodman, professor at the University of Cambridge. Contemporary narrative accounts don't give much detail about how he did it, but William of Malmesbury in the 12th century does. He talks about the fact that Æthelstan had to raise the Viking fortress at York to the ground. Æthelstan had taken the political and symbolic heart of Scandinavian power in Britain, a place linked to the wider Viking world. Fateful meeting. Æthelstan now effectively ruled a united England. Yet would his neighbors accept this new reality? He again acted decisively by traveling to Eamont Bridge in Cumbria, where he summoned rulers who were also potential enemies. Eamont Bridge was the boundary of Æthelstan's extended kingdom, but there were good reasons for choosing this location. It was a place where Roman roads converged, making travel relatively easy. It was also a locale rich in symbolism. There was a Roman fort there, there were Maybur Henge, and there were King Arthur's Round Table Henge, says Woodman. There was a landscape of authority and kingly power that Æthelstan harnessed to his own benefit. The agreements made in Cumbria were recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. One phrase in particular stands out to Woodman. It says that they all agreed with Æthelstan that they would stop idolatry, explains Woodman. The Old English word, which is a compound made up of devil and money, it literally means devil money. That points to how Viking power was conceptualized in Æthelstan's England. Paganism, violence, and silver were linked in Anglo-Saxon thinking. Viking leaders were known for using silver acquired through raiding, tribute, and trade to secure loyalty. From an English Christian perspective, Viking wealth was tainted by paganism and bloodshed. By weaponizing these payments, Æthelstan was delegitimizing a key Viking strategy. It raises an interesting possibility that actually part of the agreement at Eamont Bridge was that none of the kings would side with the Vikings, who were thought of as a kind of plague sent by the devil, says Woodman. If his various regional rivals accepted Viking money and support, Æthelstan's newly expanded kingdom could be destabilized in an instant. I think it would have been a big fear of his, said Woodman. By forcing neighboring kings to renounce these connections, Æthelstan isolated the Viking power, militarily, diplomatically, and economically. From AD 927 onwards, Æthelstan further consolidated his position as England's overlord. Viking coalitions still rose against him, but not least in the decisive Battle of Brudenburg in AD 937, where they were roundly defeated because they could no longer call on British allies. David Woodman was speaking to David Musgrove on the History Extra podcast, episode Æthelstan, the King Who Made England. You're listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Next, a treaty transformed North American history. California became American territory just days after gold had been discovered in the Sierra Nevada foothills, and Mexico lost out. In February 1848, after almost 2 years of conflict, Mexico signed a peace treaty that ended the war with the United States. The Mexican-American War was a conflict Mexico no longer had any chance of winning. It was a humiliation for the country, which lost a huge swath of territory, significantly expanding the American frontier to the west and south. The 1848 treaty brought peace, but just 9 days before it was signed, unbeknown to negotiators, gold had been found in California, then a soon-to-be American territory. The discovery came on January 24, 1848, when James W. Marshall discovered flakes of gold while supervising construction of a sawmill in the Sierra Nevada foothills. For Mexico, the timing couldn't have been any crueler. According to Paul Gillingham, author of Mexico, A History, this was one of the most consequential turning points in North American history. To understand why, it helps to know that when Mexico achieved independence from Spain in 1821, it inherited an enormous territorial claim. On paper, the new republic stretched, to quote Gilliam, from Oregon in this giant triangle to Texas, then down to Guatemala, borders that represented the legacy of Spanish colonial administration. After 1848, roughly half of this territory passed to the United States, as stated under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Almost immediately, the loss became central to Mexican politics. Nationalists claimed to have lost half of their entire national territory. "It isn't really true," Gillingham said. "No one really owned the territory above Southern California. It was the indigenous peoples. Large areas of what would later become the American Southwest were sparsely settled by Mexicans and only weakly integrated into the Mexican state. Breaking away." This lack of control became clear in 1845 when Texas, which had first declared independence from Mexico in 1836, was admitted into the Union as the 28th state. This move was driven by a broader U.S. ambition to expand westward, represented in the ideology of manifest destiny, the quasi-religious belief that the United States was destined to span the continent. This also was an era when the United States was becoming wealthier, more unified, and increasingly industrialized. In contrast, Mexico in the 1840s was divided, driven by frequent changes of government and weak institutions. By the time peace negotiations began, U.S. forces had occupied much of northern and central Mexico, including Mexico City. Mexico's bargaining position was effectively gone. As Gillingham put it, their national state was destroyed. Why, then, did the United States not take more territory? Mexico's mountainous interior was often difficult to occupy and favorable to local resistance. Like anywhere else around the world, people who live in mountains tend to be good at war and don't like other people treading on their turf, says Gillingham. Any further American advancement would have involved heavy losses and diminishing returns. The further-sighted Americans realized they had got about as much as they would ever get, Gillingham says. Mexico signed the peace treaty because it lacked the capacity to continue fighting. The United States signed because it had secured its strategic aims without overextending itself. But even with manifest destiny propelling them, some on the American side were conflicted about taking so much Mexican land. The American negotiator, Nicholas Trist, for instance, was racked by guilt at what he was doing and attempted to derail the agreement so that Mexico might retain more territory. Nevertheless, in 1848, California became American territory. Yet had California remained Mexican, what might have happened? Mexico might well have enjoyed the kind of gold-fueled growth the U.S. experienced. According to Gillingham, within 2 years, the gold production from San Francisco would have paid off the entire Mexican national debt. He adds that Mexico had all these plans for national banks, development banks, for industrialization, which never happened because the capital wasn't there. Seen in this light, the loss to Mexico was more than territorial. It wasn't so much what was already there as what would have been there that Mexico lost, he said. You've got a loss of national identity, you've got a loss of territory, you've got a loss of the future. Paul Gillingham spoke to Spencer Meisen on the History Extra podcast episode, Tragedy and Triumph, a 500-year history of Mexico. Next story, history has been unkind to much maligned Roman ruler. Domitian has been painted as a tyrant, but there are good reasons to be suspicious of what we think we know. The picture we have of the best-known Roman emperors is in many respects binary. There were good emperors who governed wisely, brought stability, and there were bad emperors whose tenures dissolved into cruelty and paranoia. Nero and Caligula are the most infamous names in the latter category, but Domitian, reigned AD 81 to 96, is often considered to be not far behind. According to Edward J. Watts, author of The Romans, A 2,000-Year History, our mental picture of the worst Roman emperors rests on scant evidence. As for Domitian, he is grossly underappreciated, says Watts. In great part, this is because the earliest surviving narratives of the Roman emperors weren't written by neutral observers. Rather, their authors were members of Roman's senatorial and literary elite who were deeply invested in the dynamics and mechanics of power. Among the most influential was Suetonius, someone Watts describes as incredibly gifted biographer. His The 12 Caesars remains a widely read account of Julius Caesar and Rome's first 11 emperors. Suetonius finished his narrative with Domitian's reign, says Watts, because he wanted to show it as the endpoint of Rome's moral and political decline. The emperor's assassination is framed as a cleansing restoration. This in turn shaped how later generations understood both Domitian and the nature of imperial power itself. Is it fair? Certainly, Domitian, the third and final member of the Flavian dynasty, didn't do himself any favors. Unlike earlier emperors who attempted to maintain a display of senatorial partnership, Domitian ruled as an unapologetic autocrat when he took power in AD 81. Promote and reform. Yet, that's not the whole story. What Domitian did was find talented people like Suetonius who were bouncing around at the very lowest levels of Roman elite life, and he turbocharged them, says Watts. He had a difficult relationship with the Roman Senate, and he wanted new people in positions of power who he could trust. By promoting capable administrators, Domitian weakened the aristocracy's grip on the state. From a practical standpoint, the policy worked. Under Domitian, Rome's finances and administration were stabilized, and the empire avoided civil war for 15 years, a considerable achievement by Roman standards. From the Senate's perspective, though, this circumvention was intolerable. Domitian was assassinated in a palace conspiracy that included his wife. The new regime that came in disavowed Domitian and called him a tyrant, says Watts. This denunciation placed prominent figures promoted by Domitian in an awkward position. All of these people, including Suetonius, scrambled to figure out how they could find a new place for themselves in the new regime, says Watts, so they turned on Domitian really aggressively. Condemning Domitian served two purposes. It legitimized the new order and distanced its beneficiaries from the fallen emperor. Suetonius's imperial biography explicitly goes through the succession and ends with Domitian as this horrible figure, says Watts. He also does a tremendous number on Caligula and on Nero as well. Watts argues that not all of these emperors were equally bad, or if bad at all. Aside from Caligula, I have tried really hard to redeem Caligula, says Watts. I don't think that can be done. Watts paints Nero, however, as a more complex case. Early in his reign, Nero pursued reforms and cultivated public support, but his ambitions outpaced his abilities. He had ideas that made sense, says Watts. He was just too incompetent and foolish to execute them. Over time, Nero's rule became increasingly violent and erratic. Conversely, Domitian, while he was demanding and suspicious of opposition, was an effective leader. His bad reputation, in Watts' estimation, can be blamed squarely on the delicate situation faced by his first biographers. James Osborne is a senior content producer for History Extra. Edward Watts spoke to Spencer Meason on the History Extra podcast episode, Secrets of the Romans' Spectacular Success. You've been listening to History Extra on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is classical Royal British music by D'Lo Sound. You can take Sunsounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sunsounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Please join us next time for an upcoming episode. Thank you.